If you were here earlier this morning, you would notice a flurry of activity. Last time I was here, I heard that the people over in this section had a little more difficulty in seeing what was on the wall. And so what I decided to do at that time was to get a splitter. I have my own screen over here, and my projector is being used. And so what would happen is that the computer would feed the video to that projector and to the other projector at the same time, and it would be through a splitter. Then it didn't work. So I'm not going to give up, but the thought was pretty good. The French words in this very prosaic painting says, "This is not a pipe." If not a pipe, what is it? If a surrealist painter, actually he paints some very strange things. You've probably seen the painting of men dressed up falling as like raindrops, and so he was a very famous painter, René Magritte, and he painted this in 1828-1829. And it was part of a group of paintings that he called the Treachery of Images, or the Treason of Images. And he wrote what at one point, because he was getting some criticism for this painting, if I had written in my picture, "This is a pipe," I'd have been lying. Indeed, he would have been. If not a pipe, what is it that he painted? Well, when I show you this, you'll know what the answer is. This is a pipe. You can stuff tobacco in here, you can light it with a match, and you can puff away. You cannot do that with what he painted. That's not a pipe, it's a picture of a pipe. Okay. And I put here, and the word P-I-P-E is not a pipe either. It's the word pipe. This confusion of what is tangible and what is not is something that seriously erodes some of our society at points. Okay. The evidence says that evolution is true. And the rock says, "I said no such thing." But you think how often that we attribute that. Okay, one more. And then there's the atom. On the left-hand side, you see what we often have in science textbooks, and that's an atom. But really not. The picture on the right-hand side is truer in the sense that the atoms, the electrons are moving so fast and in so many different positions that it creates that kind of a matrix of what one sees. But even that is not true. Because if we can locate where an electron is at any one point, we can't determine its speed. And if we can determine its speed, then we don't know where it is. And that's basic to quantum mechanics. There's something else that's wrong with this picture. And that is that an atom is mostly empty space. At least in this atom, from the nucleus to the first electron, if the nucleus was here, the first electron would probably be in Katy, Texas. So this too is an image that leads us in the wrong direction in terms of our thinking. The mathematician and philosopher Alfred North Whitehead labeled this misplaced concreteness, treating as real something that is only a representation of the real. Social scientists call it reification. Theologians call it idolatry. William James called it the psychologist fallacy, confusing the label placed on a person with the person himself or herself. The Supreme Court got it right when they decided that burning the flag, which represents the country, is free speech. It can be done. Whereas blowing up the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City is a crime. The Polish cartographer Alfred Korbski wrote, "The map is not the territory." And this, as you probably know, is not Galveston. It's a map of Galveston. It's an important distinction. Because if we call it Galveston, then we commit the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. On this particular map of Galveston, where do we find the spirit of Galveston that survived the Hurricane Ike in 2008? In fact, where would you find, using this map, 502 Church Street? Einstein was very, very brave when, before his class up in Princeton, he wrote this equation on the blackboard. Could he have set off an explosion and blown the whole city to smithereens? No. So we do draw a distinction between reality and that which represents reality at times, but not always. I think as children we had it right too. Remember, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Well, that's literally true, except that we do make the words literally true, and in consequence, it causes a lot of hurt in us. And so we get words like fat and stupid and ugly, and those words really hurt, even though they're not real. So misplaced concreteness can be representation, like Magritte's pipe, but it can also be a representation as real as something that is imaginary. As a nation, we continue to be hurt by this misplaced concreteness. Okay. Remember what we used to hear from Washington? Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and would soon attack us. And if he didn't attack us, he would give them to Al-Qaeda and they would do the deed. We would be greeted as liberators. The Iraq war would pay for itself out of Iraq's oil revenues. But think of what the reality was. How many families were in grief over the death of a child? Or think of the 18 to 24 daily suicides of veterans. Think of the billions of dollars that are no longer available for our schools and our infrastructure. What we were not told by the folks in charge in Washington was that what they thought was going to happen, or what they hoped was going to happen, really did not. And so we were told that these things were concrete facts, and anyone who didn't accept the facts either was a fool, a coward, or perhaps a traitor. Misplaced concreteness. Okay. Well, now I'd like to shift to the second part of this sermon. This is the second of three parts. Religious language. With that as a foundation, I want to move into another area of life, one that is rife with misplaced concreteness, religion, and especially talk about God. God doesn't always get mentioned that much in a Unitarian church. I tend to do more of it because of my background, because I still think it's a valid word to pick up a lot of meaning of conversation in the religious area. With my job as executive director of the Foundation for Contemporary Theology, I got involved in a lot more conversations about religion than most people do, because people are confused as to what contemporary theology is. Surprisingly, there are one of the places where people would almost give a litmus test was virgin birth. And it seemed strange that that focused on that. And I would learn to respond by saying to people who wanted to know if I believed in the virgin birth, to say, of course I believe in the virgin birth. I believe that Jesus was born of a virgin in the same way that I believe that George W. Bush was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. And in the silence, I would then say, no one ever asked me whether the spoon is silver or silver plate. Because it functions in the same way. That is, we use the expression of someone born with a silver spoon in their mouth to indicate that that individual had certain privileges early in life. And the same thing was true in the ancient world. They didn't have silver spoons, but they had virgin births. And it was only important people that were born of virgins because of gods, because that was a way of saying, well, why did this person become so prominent? And since they did not have contemporary ways of exploring a person's past, they used the example of, or the picture of a person born of a god. So virgin birth served the same rhetorical purpose in the ancient world. It is an attempt to give some understanding to the mystery of the special quality of extraordinary individuals. You note that the virgin birth or the silver spoon never happened for a common ordinary person, only for one who has attained prominence. But to use that as truth is an example of misplaced concreteness. And it's much of the truth of the word God as well. Okay. And what I've done here is to take three well-known people who have spoken about God, and I want to see how that tests out in your own mind. The first person is Buckminster Fuller. He was, of course, an architect, a systems theorist. He popularized the widely known geodesic dome. His grandfather was a Unitarian minister, and he himself was a Unitarian throughout his life. He was expelled from Harvard twice. In 1927, married and broke, drinking heavily, taking long walks around Chicago, contemplating suicide so that his family could benefit from a life insurance policy. He had a profound experience. He felt that as though he was suspended several feet above the ground, enclosed in a white light, sphere of light. And then a voice spoke to him with these words: "You do not have the right to eliminate yourself. You do not belong to yourself. You belong to the universe. Your significance will remain forever obscure to you, but you may assume that you are fulfilling your role if you apply yourself to converting your experience to the highest advantage of others." I've never had a voice speak to me. But I know a lot of people who have. Individuals who, for all I know, are perfectly normal, rational, well-educated, and yet something happened in their life that turned their life around. We see that in some of the near-death experiences that people relate. It's easy to dismiss all that, but it's part of people's experience. It has a profound effect on many people, and as such, it begins to influence the way they think about God, for example. Buckminster Fuller, in 1970 book, "I Seem to Be a Verb," wrote, "I live on earth at present, and I don't know what I am. I know that I am not a category, I am not a thing, a noun. I seem to be a verb, an evolutionary process, an integrated function of the universe." And it was out of that that he came up with this definition of God. It isn't the man in the sky, as we often have pictured God. For God, to me, it seems, is a verb, not a noun proper or improper, is the articulation, not the art, is loving, not the abstraction of love. Yes, God is a verb, the most active, connoting the vast harmonic reordering of the universe from unleashed chaos of energy. Well, what do you think about that as a definition? It sort of picks up what Einstein had in his formula, that E equals mc squared, that basically everything is energy. I like what he wrote. Well, then there's another second person that I want to do, and this is Einstein. Einstein was very clearly not a God believer. He variously identified himself as a believer in a pantheistic God, a Baruch Spinoza, but not a personal God. He also called himself at times an agnostic, but not an atheist. He preferred, as he said, an attitude of humility corresponding to the weakness of our intellectual understanding of nature and of our own being. And so here you have a person who is more of a mystical approach to God. The most beautiful emotion we can experience is the mystical. It is the power of all true art and science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. To know that what is impenetrable to us really exists, manifesting itself as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty, which our dull facilities can comprehend only in their most primitive forms. This knowledge, this feeling, is at the center of true religiousness. In this sense, and in this sense only, I belong to the rank of devoutly religious men. Do you find yourself resonating with that? And then there's a third person I wanted to bring up. This is Paul Tillich. Paul Tillich, at the age of 28, he's German, and he was in the First World War out in the trenches. And he was he dug graves, and he acted as the pastor to the troops. He wrote to his father, "Hell rages around us. It's unimaginable." What do you do when you're in a situation like that? More and more, Tillich came up to the realization that a certain view of God had died in the trenches of Europe. The nice God who would make all things work out for the best had died. And in his writing, death and doubt and the demonic were three dark themes that he had to deal with. The name of infinite and inexhaustible depth and ground of our being is God. That is, instead of looking up, let's look down in the depth of our experience where we have felt sorrow and grief and rage. The depth is what the word God means. And if that word has not much meaning for you, translate it and speak of the depths of your life, of the source of your being, of your ultimate concern, of what you take seriously without any reservation. Perhaps in order to do so, you must forget everything traditional that you've learned about God, perhaps even the word itself. For if you know that God means depth, you know much about him. You cannot then call yourself an atheist or unbeliever, for you cannot think or say, life has no depth. Life itself is shallow. Being itself is surface only. If you could say this in complete seriousness, you would be an atheist, but otherwise you are not. So this particular sermon has gone a long way around in talking about, eventually, stewardship. I've taken this route to talk about stewardship because it seems to me that what we have done is to take the word stewardship and individualize it. We Americans are highly individualistic, and we do it with this word too. This word is a corporate word. It's a relational word. To be a steward means to serve others and to be under someone in terms of carrying out tasks given to oneself. We see that in a flight attendant or others. It's also a way of looking at our way, it's a way of looking at the way that we carry out our life. If we are a steward, we manage or look after another's property. And Christians always had a very easy way of talking about stewardship. They said that God created all, we are all stewards, we all have responsibility. But what kind of a God do we have within which we exercise our stewardship? And that's the reason that I put down those three individuals who spoke about God. Do you see yourself as being part of the active energy of the universe of 13.7 billion years that brought us to where we are today and where we will return, coming from stardust and returning to stardust? Or is it that perhaps the awesomeness of life, standing in awe of nature around, or the vitality of other people and parts, or is it that we experience that which we call God in the depths of our very being? A person who looks after others as a person who is a steward, a person who is a steward finds that the giving of money is an opportunity to understand oneself better. It also is an opportunity to think about how we are expressing our lives in the world around us. This place of concreteness is a way of killing life around us. It's something that has to be resisted. And when it comes to giving, we find that instead of being engaging in the treachery of images, we engage in life itself. Created, and we return the compliment. As someone once said, that God created us, we've been returning the compliment ever since. And so we always have to ask the question, what it is we are doing when we express that word. But it is a way of understanding ourselves, of giving shape to the world that in which we live. Thank you. from this is a pipe to stewardship. This is not a pipe to stewardship. When you go through the week and you encounter your conversations with other people and with yourself, ask yourself how many times you too are engaging in misplaced concreteness. Thank you.